Earth in anything but atmosphere-skimming converted airplanes. Their flat films had shown epic space battles. Huge interstellar dreadnoughts with incredible armament lunging through space like streamlined cities. Even the spate of recent war hollies after the Battle of Brescia showed great fleets battling it out at distances two ground soldiers would find claustrophobic. Ships ramming and firing and burning, like Greek triremes packed into the Straits of Artemisium. It's little wonder, then, that my heart was pounding and my palms were a bit moist as I stepped onto the flagship of the fleet, expecting to emerge onto the broad bridge of a warship out of the hollies. Giant screens showing enemy ships, klaxon sounding, craggy commanders huddled over the technical command panels as the ship lurched first right, then left. Hunt and I were standing in what could have been a narrow corridor of a power plant. Color-coded pipes twisted everywhere. Occasional handholds and airtight hatches at regular intervals suggested that we were indeed in a spacecraft. State-of-the-art disk key and interact panels showed that the corridor served some purpose other than access to elsewhere. But the overall effect was one of claustrophobia and primitive technology. I half expected to see wires running from circuit nodes. A vertical shaft intersected our corridor. Other narrow, cluttered avenues were visible through other hatches. Hunt looked at me and shrugged slightly. I wondered if it was possible that we had forecast to the wrong destination. Before either of us said anything, a young Force space ensign in black battle dress appeared from one of the side corridors, saluted Hunt, and said, "Welcome to the HS Hebrides, gentlemen. Admiral Nishita had asked me to convey his compliments and to invite you to the Combat Control Center. If you will follow me, please." With that, the young ensign wheeled, reached for a rung, and pulled himself into a cramped vertical shaft. We followed as best we could, Hunt struggling not to drop his valise, and me trying not to have my hands ground under Hunt's heels as we climbed. After only a few yards, I realized that the gravity was far less than one standard here, was not, in fact, gravity at all, but felt more like a multitude of small but insistent hands pressing me down. I knew about spacecraft using a Class 1 containment field throughout a ship to simulate gravity, but this was my first direct experience of it. It was not a truly pleasant sensation. The constant pressure was rather like leaning into a wind, and the effect added to the claustrophobic qualities of the narrow corridors, small hatches, and equipment-cluttered bulkheads. The Hebrides was a 3C ship, Communication Control Command, and the Combat Control Center was its heart and brain. But it was not a very impressive heart and brain. The young ensign passed us through three airtight hatches, led us down a final corridor past Marine guards, saluted, and left us in a room perhaps 20 yards square, but one so crowded with noise, personnel, and equipment that one's first instinct was to step back outside the hatch to get a breath of air. There were no giant screens, but dozens of young Force space officers hunkered over cryptic displays, sat enmeshed in stim-sim apparatus, or stood before pulsing call-ups which seemed to extend from all six bulkheads. Men and women were lashed into their chairs and sensory cradles, with the exception of a few officers, most looking more like harried bureaucrats than craggy warriors, who wandered the narrow aisles, patting subordinates on the back, barking for more information and plugging into consoles with their own implant jacks. One of these men came over in a hurry, looked at us both, saluted me, and said, "M. Hunt?" I nodded toward my companion. "M. Hunt," said the overweight young commander. "Admiral Nishita will see you now." The commander of all hegemony forces in the Hyperion system was a small man with short white hair, skin far smoother than his age suggested, and a fierce scowl that seemed carved in place. Admiral Nishita wore high-necked dress black with no rank insignia except for the single red dwarf sun on his collar. His hands were blunt and quite powerful-looking, but the nails were recently manicured. The admiral sat on a small dais, surrounded by equipment and quiescent call-ups. The bustle and efficient madness seemed to flow around him like a fast stream around an impervious rock.
"You're the messenger from Gladstone," he said to Hunt. "Who's this?"
"My aide,"
said Lee Hunt. I resisted the urge to raise an eyebrow.
What do you want? Asked Nishita. As you see, we're busy.
Lee Hunt nodded and glanced around.
I have some materials for you, Admiral. Is there any place we can go for privacy?
Admiral Nishita grunted, passed his palm over a rheosense, and the air behind me grew denser, coalescing into a semi-solid mist as the containment field reified. The noise of the combat control center disappeared. The three of us were in a small igloo of quiet.
Hurry it up, said Admiral Nishita.
Hunt unlocked the valise and removed a small envelope with a Government House symbol on the back.
A private communication from the chief executive, said Hunt. To be read at your leisure, Admiral.
Nishita grunted and set the envelope aside. Hunt set a larger envelope on the desk.
And this is a hard copy of the motion of the Senate regarding the prosecution of this, military action. As you know, the will of the Senate is for this to be a speedy exercise of force to achieve limited objectives, with as little loss of life as possible, followed by the standard offer of help and protection to our new colonial asset.
Nishita's scowl twitched slightly. He made no move to touch or read the communication containing the will of the Senate.
Is that all?
Hunt took his time responding.
That is all. Unless you wish to relay a personal message to the CEO through me, Admiral.
Nishita stared. There was no active hostility in his small black eyes, only an impatience that I guessed would not be quenched until those eyes were dimmed by death.
I have private fatline access to the chief executive, said the Admiral. Thank you very much, M. Hunt. No return messages at this time. Now, if you will kindly return to the midship's Farcaster Nexus, and let me get on with prosecuting this military action.
The containment field collapsed around us, and noise flowed in like water over a melting ice dam.
There is one other thing, said Lee Hunt,
his soft voice almost lost under the techno-babble of the combat center. Admiral Nishita swiveled his chair and waited.
We'd like to transport down to the planet, said Hunt. Down to Hyperion.
The Admiral's scowl seemed to deepen.
CEO Gladstone's people said nothing about arranging a dropship.
Hunt did not blink. Governor General Lane knows that we might be coming. Nishita glanced at one of his call-ups, snapped his fingers, and barked something at a Marine major who hurried over.
You'll have to hurry, the Admiral said to Hunt. There is a courier just ready to leave from Port 20. Major Inverness will show you the way. You will be brought back up to the primary jump ship. The Hebrides will be departing this position in 23 minutes.
Hunt nodded and turned to follow the Major. I tagged along. The Admiral's voice stopped us.
M. Hunt, he called. Please tell CEO Gladstone that the flagship will be too busy from this point on for any more political visits.
Nishita turned away to flickering call-ups and a line of waiting subordinates. I followed Hunt and the Major back into the maze.
There should be windows.
What? I had been thinking about something, not paying attention. Lee Hunt turned his head toward me.
I've never been in a dropship without windows or view screens. It's strange.
I nodded and looked around, noticing the cramped and crowded interior for the first time. It was true that there were only blank bulkheads and heaps of supplies and one young lieutenant in the passenger hold of the dropship with us. It seemed to conform to the claustrophobic ambience of the command ship. I looked away, returning to the thoughts that had preoccupied me since we left Nishita. Following the other two to Port 20, it had suddenly occurred to me that I was not missing something I had expected to miss. Part of my anxiety toward this trip had lain in the thought of leaving the datasphere. I was rather like a fish contemplating leaving the sea. Part of my consciousness lay submerged somewhere in that sea, the ocean of data and comm links from 200 worlds and the core, all linked by the invisible medium once called Datum Plane, now known only as the Megasphere. It struck me as we left Nishita that I could still hear the pulse of that particular sea. distant but constant, like the sound of the surf half a mile from the shore, and I have been trying to understand it all during the rush to the dropship, the buckling in and separation, and the 10-minute cislunar sprint to the fringes of Hyperion's atmosphere. Force prided itself on using its own artificial intelligences, its own dataspheres and computing sources. The ostensible reason lay in the requirement to operate in the great spaces between web worlds, the dark and quiet places between the stars and beyond the web megasphere. But much of the real reason lay in a fierce need for independence, which Force had shown toward the Technocore for centuries. Yet on a Force ship in the center of a Force armada in a non-web, non-protectorate system, I was tuned to the same comforting background babble of data and energy that I would have found anywhere in the web. Interesting. I thought of the links the Farcaster had brought to Hyperion system. Not just the jump ship and Farcaster containment sphere floating at Hyperion's L3 point like a gleaming new moon, but the miles of gigachannel fiber optic cable snaking through permanent jump ship Farcaster portals, microwave repeaters mechanically shuttling the few inches to repeat their messages in near real time, command ship tame AIs requesting and receiving new links to the Olympus High Command on Mars and elsewhere. Somewhere, the datasphere had crept in, perhaps unknown to the Force machines and their operators and allies. The core AIs knew everything happening here in Hyperion system. If my body were to die now, I would have the same escape path as always, fleeing down the pulsing links that led like secret passages beyond the web, beyond any vestige of datum plane as humanity had known it, down data link tunnels to the techno core itself. Not really to the core, I thought, because the core surrounds, envelops the rest, like an ocean holding separate currents, great gulf streams which think themselves separate seas.
"I just wish there was a window," whispered Leigh Hunt.
"Yes," I said. "So do I." The drop ship bucked and vibrated as we entered Hyperion's upper atmosphere. Hyperion, I thought. The Shrike. My heavy shirt and vest seemed sticky and clinging. A faint susurration from without said that we were flying, streaking across the lapis skies at several times the speed of sound. The young lieutenant leaned across the aisle.
"First time down, gentlemen?"
Hunt nodded. The lieutenant was chewing gum, showing how relaxed he was.
"You two civilian techs from the Hebrides?"
"We just came from there, yes," said Hunt.
"Thought so," grinned the lieutenant. "Me, I'm running a courier pack down to the Marine base near Keats, my fifth trip."
A slight jolt ran through me as I was reminded of the name of the capital. Hyperion had been repopulated by Sad King Billy and his colony of poets, artists, and other misfits fleeing an invasion of their home world by Horace Glennon Height, an invasion which never came. The poet on the current Shrike pilgrimage, Martin Silenus, had advised King Billy almost two centuries earlier in the naming of the capital. Keats. The locals called the old part Jacktown.
"You're not going to believe this place," said the lieutenant. "It's the real anal end of nowhere. I mean, no datasphere, no EMVs, no Farcasters, no stim-sim bars, no nothing. It's no wonder that there are thousands of the fucking indigenes camped around the spaceport, just tearing down the fence to get off-world."
"Are they really attacking the spaceport?" asked Hunt.
"Nah," said the lieutenant, and snapped his gum. "But they're ready to, if you know what I mean. That's why the 2nd Marine Battalion has set up a perimeter there and secured the way into the city. Besides, the yokels think that we're going to set up Farcasters any day now and let them step out of the shit they got themselves into."
"They got themselves into?" I said. The lieutenant shrugged.
"They must have done something to get the ousters cricked at them, right? We're just here to pull their oysters out of the fire."
"Chestnuts," said Leigh Hunt.
The gum snapped.
"Whatever."
The susurration of wind grew to a shriek, clearly audible through the hull. The dropship bounced twice and then slid smoothly, ominously smoothly, as if it had encountered a chute of ice 10 miles above the ground.
"I wish we had a window,"
whispered Leigh Hunt. It was warm and stuffy in the dropship. The bouncing was oddly relaxing, rather like a small sailing ship rising and falling on slow swells. I closed my eyes for a few minutes. 10. Saul, Braun, Martin Silenus and the consul carry gear, Hetmestine's Mobius cube, and the body of Lenar Hoyt down the long incline to the entrance of the Sphinx. Snow is falling rapidly now, twisting across the already writhing dune surfaces in a complex dance of wind-driven particles. Despite their comlog's claim that night nears its end, there is no hint of sunrise to the east. Repeated calls on their comlog radio link bring no response from Colonel Cassatt. Saul Weintraub pauses before the entrance to the time tomb called the Sphinx. He feels his daughter's presence as a warmth against his chest under the cape, the rise and fall of warm baby's breath against his throat. He raises one hand, touches the small bundle there, and tries to imagine Rachel as a young woman of 26, a researcher pausing at this very entrance before going in to test the anti-entropic mysteries of the time tomb. Saul shakes his head. It has been 26 long years, and a lifetime since that moment. In 4 days it will be his daughter's birthday. Unless Saul does something, finds the shrike, makes some bargain with the creature, does something, Rachel will die in 4 days. "Are you coming, Saul?" calls Braun Lamia. The others have stored their gear in the first room, half a dozen meters down the narrow corridor through stone. "Coming," he calls and enters the tomb. Glow globes and electric lights line the tunnel, but they are dead and dust-covered. Only Saul's flashlight and the glow from one of Kassad's small lanterns light the way. The first room is small, no more than 4 by 6 meters. The other three pilgrims have set their baggage against the back wall and spread tarp and bedrolls in the center of the cold floor. Two lanterns hiss and cast a cold light. Saul stops and looks around. "Father Hoyt's body is in the next room," says Braun Lamia, answering his unasked question. "It's even colder there." Saul takes his place near the others. Even this far in, he can hear the rasp of sand and snow blowing against stone. "The consul is going to try the comlog again later," says Braun. "Tell Gladstone the situation." Martin Silenus laughs.
"It's no use. No fucking use at all. She knows what she's doing, and she's never going to let us out of here."
"I'll try just after sunrise," says the consul. His voice is very tired.
"I will stand watch," says Saul.
Rachel stirs and cries feebly.
"I need to feed the baby anyway."
The others seem too tired to respond. Braun leans against a pack, closes her eyes, and is breathing heavily within seconds. The consul pulls his tricorn cap low over his eyes. Martin Silenus folds his arms and stares at the doorway, waiting. Saul Weintraub fusses with a nursing pack, his cold and arthritic fingers having trouble with the heating tab. He looks in his bag and realizes that he has only 10 more packs, a handful of diapers. The baby is nursing, and Saul is nodding, almost sleeping, when a sound wakes them all.
"What?"
cries Braun, fumbling for her father's pistol.
"Shh!"
snaps the poet, holding his hand out for silence. From somewhere beyond the tomb comes the sound again. It is flat and final, cutting through the wind noise and sand rasp.
"Cassad's rifle," says Braun Lamia. "Or someone else's,"
whispers Martin Silenus. They sit in silence and strain to hear. For a long moment, there is no sound at all. Then, in an instant, the night erupts with noise, noise which makes each of them cringe and cover his or her ears. Rachel screams in terror, but her cries cannot be heard over the explosions and rendings beyond the tomb. 11. I awoke just as the dropship touched down. Hyperion, I thought, still separating my thoughts from the tatters of dream.
The young lieutenant wished us luck and was the first out as the door irised open and cool, thin air replaced the pressurized thickness of the cabin atmosphere. I followed Hunt out and down a standard docking ramp, through the shield wall and onto the tarmac. It was night, and I had no idea what the local time was. Whether the Terminator had just passed this point on the planet or was just approaching, but it felt and smelled late. It was raining softly. A light drizzle perfumed with the salt scent of the sea and the fresh hint of moistened vegetation. Field lights glared around the distant perimeter, and a score of lighted towers threw halos toward the low clouds. A half-dozen young men in marine field uniforms were quickly unloading the dropship, and I could see our young lieutenant speaking briskly to an officer 30 yards to our right. The small spaceport looked like something out of a history book. A colonial port from the earliest days of the Hegira. Primitive blast pits and landing squares stretched for a mile or more toward a dark bulk of hills to the north. Gantries and service towers tended to a score of military shuttles and small warcraft around us. And the landing areas were ringed by modular military buildings, sporting antennae arrays, violet containment fields, and a clutter of skimmers and aircraft. I followed Hunt's gaze and noticed a skimmer moving toward us. The blue and gold geodesic symbol of the hegemony on one of its skirts was illuminated by its running lights. Rain streaked the forward blisters and whipped away from the fans in a violent curtain of mist. The skimmer settled, a perspex blister split and folded, and a man stepped out and hurried across the tarmac toward us. He held out his hand to Hunt.
"M. Hunt? I'm Theo Lane."
Hunt shook the hand, nodded toward me.
"Pleased to meet you, Governor General. This is Joseph Severn."
I shook Lane's hand, a shock of recognition coming with the touch. I remembered Theo Lane through the deja vu mists of the consul's memory, recalling the years when the young man was the vice consul. Also from a brief meeting a week earlier when he greeted all of the pilgrims before they departed upriver on the levitation barge Benares. He seemed older than he had appeared just 6 days before, but the unruly lock of hair on his forehead was the same, as were the archaic eyeglasses he wore and the brisk, firm handshake.
"I'm pleased you could take the time to make planetfall," Governor General Lane said to Hunt. "I have several things I need to communicate to the CEO."
"That's why we're here," said Hunt.
He squinted up at the rain.
"We have about an hour. Is there somewhere we can dry off?"
The Governor General showed a youthful smile.
"The field here is a madhouse, even at 0520 hours, and the consulate is under siege. But I know a place."
He gestured toward the skimmer. As we lifted off, I noticed the two marine skimmers keeping pace with us. But I was still surprised that the Governor-General of a protectorate world flew his own vehicle and did not have constant bodyguards. Then I remembered what the consul had told the other pilgrims about Theo Lane, about the young man's efficiency and self-effacing ways, and realized that such a low profile was in keeping with the diplomat's style. The sun rose as we lifted off from the spaceport and banked toward town. Low clouds glowed brilliantly as they were lighted from below. The hills to the north sparkled a bright green, violet, and russet, and the strip of sky below the clouds to the east was that heart-stopping green and lapis which I remembered from my dreams. Hyperion, I thought, and felt a thick tension and excitement catch in my throat. I leaned my head against the rain-streaked canopy and realized that some of the vertigo and confusion I felt at that moment came from a thinning of the background contact with the datasphere. The connection was still there, carried primarily on microwave and fatline channels now, but more tenuous than I had ever experienced. If the datasphere had been the sea in which I swam, I was now in shallow water indeed. Perhaps a tidal pool would be a better metaphor. And the water grew even shallower as we left the envelope of the spaceport and its crude microsphere. I forced myself to pay attention to what Hunt and Governor General Lane were discussing.
"You can see the shacks and hovels," said Lane, banking slightly so we had a better view of the hills and valleys separating the spaceport from the suburbs of the capital.
Shacks and hovels were two polite terms for the miserable collection of fiberplastic panels, patches of canvas, heaps of packing crates, and shards of flow foam that covered the hills and deep canyons. What obviously had once been a scenic 7 or 8 mile drive from the city to the spaceport through wooded hills now showed land stripped of all trees for firewood and shelter, meadows beaten to barren mudflats by the press of feet, and a city of 700,000 or 800,000 refugees sprawled over every flat piece of land in sight. Smoke from thousands of breakfast fires floated toward the clouds, and I could see movement everywhere. Children running in bare feet, women carrying water from streams that must be terribly polluted, men squatting in open fields and waiting in line at makeshift privies. I noted that high razor wire fences and violet containment field barriers had been set along both sides of the highway, and military checkpoints were visible every half mile. Long lines of force-camouflaged ground vehicles and skimmers moved both directions along the highway and low-level flyways.
"Most of the refugees are indigenous," Governor General Lane was saying. "Although there are thousands of displaced landowners from the southern cities and the large fiberplastic plantations on Aquila."
"Are they here because they think the ousters will invade?" asked Hunt.
Theo Lane glanced at Gladstone's aide.
"Originally there was panic at the thought of the Time Tombs opening," he said. "People were convinced that the Shrike was coming for them."
"Was it?" I asked. The young man shifted in his seat to look back at me.
"The 3rd Legion of the Self-Defense Force went north 7 months ago," he said. "It didn't come back."
"You said at first they were fleeing the Shrike," said Hunt. "Why did the others come?"
"They're waiting for the evacuation," said Lane. "Everyone knows what the ousters and the hegemony troops did to Brescia. They don't want to be here when that happens to Hyperion."
"You're aware that Force considers evacuation an absolute last resort," said Hunt.
"Yes, but we're not announcing that to the refugees. There have been terrible riots already. The Shrike Temple has been destroyed, a mob laid siege, and someone used shape plasma charges stolen from the mine works on Ursus. Last week there were attacks on the consulate and the spaceport, as well as food riots in Jacktown."
Hunt nodded and watched the city approach. The buildings were low, few over 5 stories, and their white and pastel walls glowed richly in the slanting rays of morning light. I looked over Hunt's shoulder and saw the low mountain with the carved face of Sad King Billy brooding over the valley. The Hooghly River twisted through the center of the old town, straightening before it headed northwest toward the unseen Bridal Range, twisting out of sight in the Werewood Marshes to the southeast, where I knew it widened to its delta along the high main. The city looked uncrowded and peaceful after the sad confusion of the refugee slums. But even as we began to descend toward the river, I noticed the military traffic, the tanks and APCs and GAVs at intersections and sitting in parks, their camouflage polymer deliberately deactivated so the machines would look more threatening. Then I saw the refugees in the city, makeshift tents in the squares and alleys, thousands of sleeping forms along the curbs, like so many dull-colored bundles of laundry waiting to be picked up.
"Keats had a population of 200,000 2 years ago," said Governor General Lane. "Now, including the shack cities, we're nearing 3.5 million.
"I thought that there were fewer than 5 million people on the planet," said Hunt, "including indigenes."
"That's accurate," said Lane. "You see why everything's breaking down. The other 2 large cities, Port Romance and Endymion, are holding most of the rest of the refugees. Fiberplastic plantations on Aquila are empty, being reclaimed by the jungle and flame forests. The farm belts along the main and the Nine Tails aren't producing, or if they are, can't get their food to market because of the breakdown of the civilian transport system."
Hunt watched the river come closer.
"What is the government doing?"
Theo Lane smiled.
"You mean, what am I doing? Well, the crisis has been brewing for almost 3 years. The first step was to dissolve the Home Rule Council and formally bring Hyperion into the Protectorate. Once I had executive powers, I moved to nationalize the remaining transit companies and dirigible lines. Only the military moves by skimmer here now,
and to disband the self-defense force.
Disband it? Said Hunt. I would think you would want to use it.
Governor General Lane shook his head. He touched the Omni-control lightly, confidently, and the skimmer spiraled down toward the center of Old Keats.
They were worse than useless, he said. They were dangerous. I wasn't too upset when the fighting Third Legion went north and just disappeared. As soon as the force, ground troops, and Marines landed, I disarmed the rest of the SDF thugs. They were the source of most of the looting. Here's where we'll get some breakfast and talk.
The skimmer dropped in low over the river, circled a final time, and dropped lightly into the courtyard of an ancient structure made of stone and sticks and imaginatively designed windows. Cicero's. Even before Lane identified the place to Leigh Hunt, I recognized it from the Pilgrim's Passage. The old restaurant, pub, inn lay in the heart of Jacktown and sprawled over four buildings on 9 levels, its balconies and piers and darkened weirwood walkways overhanging the slow-moving Hooley on one side and the narrow lanes and alleys of Jacktown on the other. Cicero's was older than the stone face of Sad King Billy, and its dim cubicles and deep wine cellars had been the true home of the consul during his years of exile here. Stan Lewesky met us at the courtyard door. Tall and massive, face as age-darkened and cracked as the stone walls of his inn, Lewesky was Cicero's, as had been his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather before him.
By damn!
Declared the giant, clapping the governor-general, de facto dictator of this world, on his shoulders, hard enough to make Theo stagger.
You get up early for a change, huh? Bring your friends to breakfast? Welcome to Cicero's.
Stan Lewesky's huge hand swallowed Hunt's and then mine in a welcome that left me checking fingers and joints for damage.
Or is it later web time for you? He boomed. Maybe you like a drink or dinner.
Leigh Hunt squinted at the pub owner.
How did you know we were from the web?
Lewesky boomed a laugh that sent weather vanes on the roof line spinning.
Ha! Hard to deduct, yes? You come here with Theo at sunrise. You think he'd give everybody a ride here? Also wearing wool clothes when we got no sheeps here. You're not force people, and not fiberplastic plantation big shots. I know all those. Ipso factoto, you farcaster ships from the web drop down here for good food. Now you want breakfast or plenty to drink?
Theo Lane sighed. Give us a quiet corner, Stan. Bacon and eggs and brine kippers for me. Gentlemen?
Just coffee.
Yes, I said. We were following the owner through the corridors now, up short staircases and down wrought iron ramps, through more corridors. The place was lower, darker, smokier, and more fascinating than I remembered from my dreams. A few regulars looked up at us as we passed, but the place was far less crowded than I remembered. Obviously, Lane had sent troops to throw out the last of the SDF barbarians who had been occupying the place. We passed a high, narrow window, and I verified that hypothesis by catching a glimpse of a force-ground APC parked in the alley, troops lounging on and near it with obviously loaded weapons.
Here,
said Lewesky, waving us into a small porch which overhung the Hooley and looked out onto the gabled rooftops and stone towers of Jacktown.
Tommy be here in 2 minutes with your breakfast and coffees.
He disappeared quickly, for a giant. Hunt glanced at his comm log.
We have about 45 minutes before the dropship is supposed to return with us. Let's talk.
Lane nodded, removed his glasses and rubbed his eyes. I realized that he had been up all night, perhaps several nights.
Fine, he said, setting the glasses back in place.
What does CEO Gladstone want to know?
Hunt paused, while a very short man with parchment-white skin and yellow eyes brought our coffee in deep, thick mugs and set down a platter with Lane's food.
The CEO wants to know what you feel your priorities are, said Hunt. And she needs to know if you can hold out here if the fighting is prolonged.
Lane ate for a moment before responding. He took a long sip of coffee and stared intently at Hunt. It was real coffee, from the taste of it, better than most web-grown.
First question last, Lane said. Define prolonged.
Weeks.
Weeks? Probably. Months? No way.
The Governor General tried the brine kippers.
You see the state of our economy. If it wasn't for the supplies dropped in by force, we'd have food riots every day instead of once a week. There are no exports with the quarantine. Half the refugees want to find the Shrike temple priests and kill them. The other half want to convert before the Shrike finds them.
Have you found the priests? Asked Hunt.
No. We're sure they escaped the temple bombing, but the authorities can't locate them. Rumor has it they've gone north to Keep Kronos, a stone castle right above the high step where the time tombs are.
I knew better. At least I knew the pilgrims had not seen any Shrike temple priests during their brief stay in the keep. But there had been signs of a slaughter there.
As for our priorities, Theo Lane was saying, the first is evacuation. The second is elimination of the ouster threat. The third is help with the Shrike scare.
Lee Hunt sat back against oiled wood. Steam lifted from the heavy mug in his hands.
Evacuation is not a possibility at this time.
Why?
Lane fired the question like a hellwhip bolt.
CEO Gladstone does not have the political power. At this point, to convince the Senate and all thing that the web can accept 5 million refugees.
Bullshit, said the Governor General. There were twice that many tourists flooding Maui Covenant its first year in the Protectorate. And that destroyed a unique planetary ecology. Put us on Armagast or some desert world until the war scare is past.
Hunt shook his head. His Basset Hound eyes looked sadder than usual.
It isn't just the logistical question, he said. Or the political one, it's...
The Shrike, said Lane. He broke a piece of bacon. The Shrike is the real reason.
Yes, as well as fears of an ouster infiltration of the web.
The Governor General laughed.
So you're afraid that if you set up Farcaster portals here and let us out, a bunch of 3-meter ousters are going to land and get in line without anyone noticing?
Hunt sipped his coffee.
No, he said. But there is a real chance of an invasion. Every Farcaster portal is an opening to the web. The Advisory Council warns against it.
All right, said the younger man, his mouth half full. Evacuate us by ship, then. Wasn't that the reason for the original task force?
That was the ostensible reason, said Hunt. Our real goal now is to defeat the ousters and then bring Hyperion fully into the web.
And what about the Shrike threat, then?
It will be neutralized, said Hunt.
He paused while a small group of men and women passed by our porch. I glanced up, started to return my attention to the table, and then snapped my head back around. The group had passed out of sight down the hallway. Wasn't that Emilio Arendez? I said, interrupting Governor General Lane.
What? Oh, Dr. Arendez. Yes, do you know him, M7?
Lee Hunt was glaring at me, but I ignored it. Yes, I said to Lane. Although I had never actually met Arendez.
What is he doing on Hyperion?
His team landed over 6 local months ago with a project proposal from Rijks University on Freeholm to do additional research on the time tombs.
But the time tombs were closed to research and tourists, I said.
Yes, but their instruments, we allowed data to be relayed weekly through the consulate Fatline transmitter, had already shown the change in the anti-entropic field surrounding the tombs. Rijks University knew the tombs were opening, if that's really what the change means, and they sent the top researchers in the web to study it.
But you did not grant them permission? I said. Theo Lane smiled without warmth.
CEO Gladstone did not grant them permission. The closure of the tombs is a direct order from TC Squared. If it were up to me, I would have denied the Pilgrim's Passage and allowed Dr. Arendez's team priority access.
He turned back to Hunt. Excuse me, I said, and slipped out of the booth. I found Arendez and his people, 3 women and 4 men, their clothing and physical styles suggesting different worlds in the web, 2 porches away. They were bent over their breakfasts and scientific comm logs, arguing in technical terms so abstruse as to leave a Talmudic scholar envious. Dr. Arendez, I said.
Yes?
He looked up. He was 2 decades older than I remembered, entering middle age in his early 60s, but the strikingly handsome profile was the same, with the same bronzed skin, solid jaw, wavy black hair going only slightly gray at the temples, and piercing hazel eyes. I understood how a young female graduate student could have quickly fallen in love with him. "My name is Joseph Severn," I said. "You don't know me, but I knew a friend of yours. Rachel Weintraub?" Arendez was on his feet in a second, offering apologies to the others, leading me by the elbow until we found an empty booth in a cubicle under a round window looking out on red-tiled rooftops. He released my elbow and appraised me carefully, taking in the web clothing. He turned my wrists over, looking for the telltale blueness of Poulsen treatments.
"You're too young," he said. "Unless you knew Rachel as a child."
"Actually, it's her father I know best," I said. Dr. Arendez let out a breath and nodded.
"Of course," he said. "Where is Saul? I've been trying to trace him for months through the consulate. The authorities on Hebron will only say that he's moved."
He gave me that appraising stare again.
"You knew about Rachel's illness?"
"Yes," I said. "The Merlin sickness, which had caused her to age backward, losing memories with each day and hour that passed. Melio Arendez had been one of those memories. I know that you went to visit her about 15 standard years ago on Barnard's World." Arendez grimaced.
"That was a mistake," he said. "I thought that I would talk to Saul and Sarai. When I saw her..."
He shook his head.
"Who are you? Do you know where Saul and Rachel are now? It's 3 days until her birthday."
I nodded. "Her first and last birthday." I glanced around. The hallway was silent and empty, except for a distant murmur of laughter from a lower level. "I'm here on a fact-finding trip from the CEO's office," I said. "I have information that Saul Weintraub and his daughter have traveled to the Time Tombs." Arendez looked as though I'd struck him in the solar plexus.
"Here? On Hyperion?"
He stared out at the rooftops for a moment.
"I should have realized. Although Saul always refused to return here, but with Sarai gone..."
He looked at me.
"Are you in touch with him? Is she... Are they all right?"
I shook my head. "There are no radio or datasphere links with them at present," I said. "I know that they made the trip safely. The question is, what do you know? Your team... Data on what is occurring at the Time Tombs might be very important to their survival." Melio Arendez ran his hand through his hair.
"If only they'd let us go there. That damned stupid bureaucratic short-sightedness. You say you're from Gladstone's office. Can you explain to them why it's so important for us to get there?"
"I'm only a messenger," I said. "But tell me why it's so important, and I'll try to get the information to someone." Arendez's large hands cupped an invisible shape in midair. His tension and anger were palpable.
"For 3 years, the data was coming via telemetry and the squirts the consulate would allow once a week on their precious fatline transmitter. It showed a slow but relentless degradation of the antientropic envelope, the time tides, in and around the tombs. It was erratic, illogical, but steady. Our team was authorized to travel here shortly after the degradation began. We arrived about 6 months ago, saw data that suggested that the tombs were opening, coming into phase with now. But 4 days after we arrived, the instruments quit sending, all of them. We begged that bastard Lane to let us just go and recalibrate them, set up new sensors if he wouldn't let us investigate in person. Nothing. No transit permission, no communication with the university. Even with the coming of 4 ships to make it easier. We tried going upriver ourselves without permission, and some of Lane's marine goons intercepted us at Carla Locks and brought us back in handcuffs. I spent 4 weeks in jail. Now we're allowed to wander around Keats, but we'll be locked up indefinitely if we leave the city again."
Arendez leaned forward.
"Can you help?"
"I don't know," I said. "I want to help the Weintraubs. Perhaps it would be best if you could take your team to the site. Do you know when the tombs will open?" The time physicist made an angry gesture.
"If we had new data," he sighed. "No, we don't know. They could be open already, or it could be another 6 months."
"When you say open," I said,
You don't mean physically open.
Of course not. The time tombs have been physically open for inspection since they were discovered 4 standard centuries ago. I mean open in the sense of dropping the time curtains that conceal parts of them, bringing the entire complex into phase with the local flow of time.
By local, you mean?
I mean in this universe, of course.
And you're sure that the tombs are moving backward in time from our future? I asked.
Backward in time, yes, said Arendez. From our future, we can't say. We're not even sure what the future means in temporal physical terms. It could be a series of sine wave probabilities, or a decision branch megaverse, or even...
But whatever it is, I said, the time tombs and the Shrike are coming from there.
The time tombs for certain, said the physicist. I have no knowledge of the Shrike. My own guess is that it's a myth, fueled by the same hunger for superstitious verities that drives other religions.
Even after what happened to Rachel, I said, you still don't believe in the Shrike. Melio Arendez glowered at me.
Rachel contracted Merlin's sickness, he said. It's an antientropic aging disease, not the bite of a mythical monster.
Time's bite has never been mythical, I said. Surprising myself with such a cheap bit of homespun philosophy. The question is, will the Shrike or whatever power inhabits the time tombs return Rachel to the local time flow? Arendez nodded and turned his gaze to the rooftops. The sun had moved into the clouds and the morning was drab. The red tiles bleached of color. Rain was beginning to fall again. And the question is, I said, surprising myself again. Are you still in love with her? The physicist turned his head slowly, fixing me in an angry gaze. I felt the retort, possibly physical, build, crest, and wane. He reached into his coat pocket and showed me a snapshot holo of an attractive woman with graying hair and 2 children in their late teens.
My wife and children, said Melio Arendez. They're waiting on Renaissance Vector.
He pointed a blunt finger at me.
If Rachel were cured today, I would be 82 standard years old before she again reached the age she was when we first met.
He lowered the finger, returned the holo to his pocket.
And yes, he said, I'm still in love with her.
Ready?
The voice broke the silence a moment later. I looked up to see Hunt and Theo Lane in the doorway.
The dropship lifts off in 10 minutes, said Hunt.
I stood and shook hands with Melio Arendez. I'll try, I said. Governor General Lane had one of his escort skimmers return us to the spaceport while he went back to the consulate. The military skimmer was no more comfortable than his consulate machine had been, but it was faster. We were strapped and fielded into our web seats aboard the dropship before Hunt said,
What was all that about with that physicist?
Just renewing old ties with a stranger, I said. Hunt frowned.
What did you promise him that you'd try?
I felt the dropship rumble, twitch, and then leap as the catapult grid launched us skyward. I told him I'd try to get him in to visit a sick friend, I said. Hunt continued to frown. But I pulled out a sketch pad and doodled images of Cicero's until we docked at the jump ship 15 minutes later. It was a shock to step through the Farcaster portal into the executive nexus in Government House. Another step took us to the Senate Gallery, where Mayna Gladstone was still speaking to a packed house. Imagers and microphones carried her speech to the All-Thing and 100 billion waiting citizens. I glanced at my chronometer. It was 1,038 hours. We had been gone. Only 90 minutes. 12. The building housing the Senate of the Hegemony of Man was patterned more after the United States Senate building of 8 centuries earlier, rather than the more imperial structures of the North American Republic or the First World Council. The main assembly room was large,
girded with galleries, and big enough for the 300-plus senators from Web Worlds and the more than 70 non-voting representatives from protectorate colonies. Carpets were a rich wine red and radiated from the central dais where the president pro tem, the speaker of the All-Thing, and, today, the chief executive officer of the hegemony had their seats. Senators' desks were made of muir wood, donated by the Templars of God's Grove, who held such products sacred, and the glow and scent of burnished wood filled the room even when it was as crowded as it was today. Leigh Hunt and I entered just as Gladstone was finishing her speech. I keyed my comm log for a quick readout. As with most of her talks, it had been short, comparatively simple, without condescension or bombast, yet laced with a certain lilt of original phrasing and imagery which carried great power. Gladstone had reviewed the incidents and conflicts that led to the current state of belligerency with the ousters, proclaimed the time-honored wish for peace, which still was paramount in hegemony policy, and called for unity within the web and protectorate until this current crisis was past. I listened to her summation. "And so it has come to pass, fellow citizens, that after more than a century of peace, we are once again engaged in a struggle to maintain those rights to which our society has been dedicated since before the death of our Mother Earth. After more than a century of peace, we must now pick up, however unwillingly, however distastefully, the shield and sword, which have ever preserved our birthright and vouchsafed our common good, so that peace may again prevail. We must not, and shall not, be misled by the stir of trumpets or the rush of near joy which the call to arms inevitably produces. Those who ignore history's lessons in the ultimate folly of war are forced to do more than relive them. They may be forced to die by them. Great sacrifices may lay ahead for all of us. Great sorrows may lay in store for some of us. But come what successes or setbacks must inevitably occur, I say to you now that we must remember these two things above all. First, that we fight for peace, and know that war must never be a condition, but rather a temporary scourge which we suffer as a child does a fever, knowing that health follows the long night of pain and that peace is health. Second, that we shall never surrender. Never surrender or waver or bend to lesser voices or more comfortable impulses. Never waver until the victory is ours, aggression is undone, and the peace is won. I thank you. Leigh Hunt leaned forward and watched intently as most of the senators rose to give Gladstone an ovation that roared back from the high ceiling and struck us in the gallery in waves. Most of the senators. I could see Hunt counting those who remained sitting, some with arms folded, many with visible frowns. The war was less than 2 days old, and already the opposition was building. First from the colonial worlds afraid for their own safety, while force was diverted to Hyperion. Then from Gladstone's opponents, of which there were many, since no one stays in power as long as she without creating cadres of enemies. And finally, from members of her own coalition, who saw the war as a foolish undoing of unprecedented prosperity. I watched her leaving the dais, shaking hands with the aged president and young speaker, then taking the center aisle out, touching and talking to many, smiling the familiar smile. All-thing imagers followed her, and I could feel the pressure of the debate net swell as billions voiced their opinions on the interact levels of the megasphere.
"I need to see her now," said Hunt. "Are you aware that you're invited to a state dinner tonight at Treetops?"
"Yes." Hunt shook his head slightly, as if incapable of understanding why the CEO wanted me around.
"It will run late and will be followed by a meeting with Force Command. She wants you to attend both."
"I'll be available," I said. Hunt paused at the door.
"Do you have something to do back at Government House until the dinner?"
I smiled at him. "I'll work on my portrait sketches," I said. "Then I'll probably take a walk through Deer Park.
After that, I don't know, I may take a nap. Hunt shook his head again and hurried off. 13. The first shot misses Fedmon Kassad by less than a meter, splitting a boulder he is passing, and he is moving before the blast strikes him, rolling for cover, his camouflage polymer fully activated, impact armor tensed, assault rifle ready, visor in full targeting mode. Kassad lies there for a long moment, feeling his heart pounding and searching the hills, valley, and tombs for the slightest hint of heat or movement. Nothing. He begins to grin behind the black mirror of his visor. Whoever had shot at him had meant to miss, he is sure. They had used a standard pulse bolt, ignited by an 18-millimeter cartridge, and unless the shooter was 10 or more kilometers away, there was no chance of a miss. Kassad stands up to run toward the shelter of the jade tomb, and the second shot catches him in the chest, hurling him backward. This time he grunts and rolls away, scuttling toward the jade tomb's entrance with all sensors active. The second shot had been a rifle bullet. Whoever is playing with him is using a force, multi-purpose assault weapon similar to his own. He guesses that the assailant knows he is in body armor, knows that the rifle bullet would be ineffective at any range. But the multi-purpose weapon has other settings, and if the next level of play involves a killing laser, Kassad is dead. He throws himself into the doorway of the tomb. Still no heat or movement on his sensors, except for the red and yellow images of his fellow pilgrims' footsteps rapidly cooling where they had entered the Sphinx several minutes before. Kassad uses his tactical implants to switch displays, quickly running through VHF and optical comm channels. Nothing. He magnifies the valley 100-fold, computes in wind and sand, and activates a moving target indicator. Nothing larger than an insect is moving. He sends out radar, sonar, and Lorfo pulses, daring the sniper to home in on them. Nothing. He calls up tactical displays of the first two shots. Blue ballistic trails leap into existence. The first shot had come from the Poet City, more than 4 clicks to the southwest. The second shot, less than 10 seconds later, came from the Crystal Monolith, almost a full click down the valley to the northeast. Logic dictates that there have to be 2 snipers. Kassad is sure that there is only 1. He refines the display scale. The second shot had come from high on the monolith, at least 30 meters up on the sheer face. Kassad swings out, raises amplification, and peers through night and the last vestiges of the sand and snowstorm toward the huge structure. Nothing. No windows, no slits, no openings of any sort. Only the billions of colloidal particles left in the air from the storm allow the laser to be visible for a split second. Kassad sees the green beam after it strikes him in the chest. He rolls back into the entrance of the jade tomb, wondering if the green walls will help deter a green light lance, while superconductors in his combat armor radiate heat in every direction, and his tactical visor tells him what he already knows. The shot has come from high on the crystal monolith. Kassad feels pain sting his chest, and he looks down in time to see a 5-centimeter circle of Invulnarmor drip molten fibers onto the floor. Only the last layer has saved him. As it is, his body drips with sweat inside the suit, and he can see the walls of the tomb literally glowing with the heat his suit has discarded. Biomonitors clamor for attention but hold no serious news. His suit sensors report some circuit damage but describe nothing irreplaceable, and his weapon is still charged, loaded, and operative. Kassad thinks about it. All of the tombs are priceless archaeological treasures, preserved for centuries as a gift to future generations. Even if they are moving backward in time, it would be a crime on an interplanetary scale if Colonel Fedmon Kassad were to put his own life above the preservation of such priceless artifacts. "Oh, fuck it," whispers Kassad and rolls into firing position. He sprays laser fire across the face of the monolith until crystal slags and runs. He pumps high-explosive pulse bolts into the thing at 10-meter intervals, starting with the top levels. Thousands of shards of mirrored material fly out into the night, tumbling in slow motion toward the valley floor, leaving gaps as ugly as missing teeth.